A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the Fourth be with you all month and beyond.
Hello and welcome to the Radioactive Ramblings podcast, a show where we are going to be covering Fallout on Amazon Prime Video. I'm one of your co-hosts, Aaron.
And I'm your other co-host, Chase. Today we are covering episodes 7 and 8 of Fallout. We're going to start with a spoiler-free section with our general thoughts and impressions of the season so far before we get into scene-by-scene breakdowns of the episodes.
All right, let's get right into it with our spoiler-free thoughts. Chase, what did you think of these two episodes?
Well, first of all, these two episodes are the final episodes of the season, so I think it's fair to say this season was amazing. I really, really enjoyed this show, and I think that it might be in my top three shows for this year, honestly. I really greatly enjoyed it. I didn't think there was a single second that was boring, in all honesty. I thought it was really interesting the whole time. I think that nothing was lazily done, you know? All of the CGI looked pretty good. There were points where it was a little iffy, but nothing bad for sure. All of the writing was great, I feel like, and all of the acting and characters were really good. One thing I want to say is I think I've been seeing kind of hate for Maximus's actor online, and I think it's just people hating on him for playing the character correctly, honestly. I think he played Maximus perfectly, and I think that people are just hating on him because they don't like Maximus's character.
Yeah, you know, we saw that with Star Wars, where the actor who played Jar Jar Binks was getting death threats. We saw it with Game of Thrones, where the actor who played Joffrey was getting hate mail for it. I think we need to end this whole thing of hating on actors who are playing their characters perfectly, because, yeah, Maximus, he's a hateable character on purpose. I don't think that we're supposed to sympathize with him very much until maybe the very end of the series, but I thought the actor did a fantastic job portraying him exactly how the writers intended him to be.
Yeah, and back to our spoiler-free review of these episodes. I think that these two episodes really tied everything together, you know, set everything up for a second season for sure. Answered a lot of questions that we had and kind of proved some of our theories right, I would say.
Yeah, if you've listened to the past few episodes where we've covered episodes 1 through 6, we had a lot of theories and some of them came true, so we scored some internet points here, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Another thing about this season, it's very much, like you said, they're setting up for a season 2 without a doubt, whether or not Amazon renews it. I don't see them dropping this show. It's been a pretty big success for them. I think that they're going to renew it without a doubt. The final episode is titled The Beginning, and I think that's a really appropriate name. These final two episodes really do feel like the very beginning of a saga that's going to continue for at least a few more seasons, and I see it being one of the better shows that's going to come out and that people are going to have to look forward to. In these final two episodes, another thing that was really impressive was the amount of Easter eggs that they fit in from the games. These final two episodes were just chock full of costumes and locations and pieces of information that if you've played the games, you were going to be super excited about. If you've played especially New Vegas or some of the older Fallout games, it's really going to shine through as something that, yeah, this episode was for you, or these two episodes, rather, were for you if you've played the games. And if you haven't played the games, like Chase, I am assuming that you had a pretty good experience with these last two episodes and thought it was a good wrap-up, even if you didn't pick up on all the Easter eggs, right?
Yeah, I picked up on one Easter egg at the beginning of episode 7 just because it was pretty obvious. Other than that, I didn't pick up on anything else, but I still greatly enjoyed the two episodes and the entire show as a whole.
That's about all I have for my spoiler-free thoughts. Chase, do you have anything else?
No, that's about it.
That is going to wrap up our spoiler-free section. If you haven't seen episodes 7 and 8 yet, now is a good time to head out. Come back later once you've watched them, or stick around if you don't care about spoilers. Spoilers for these two episodes, as well as some spoilers from the Fallout games, will be fair game, and with how many Easter eggs and little tidbits of information from the Fallout games are present in this set of episodes, you can count on us talking about that a little bit. So, there is your fair warning. And we are going to give you a little bit of a heads up if we spoil anything from the games, so if you haven't played and you're just listening along with us, don't worry too much about it, we'll let you know. Alright, without further ado, let's get into episode 7, The Radio.
The radio opens up with a scene of two characters using metal detectors to scavenge for metal scraps in the wasteland, and these two characters are donning outfits that are very similar to the character's outfit on the cover of the New Vegas Fallout game.
Yes.
So that's the one I noticed, and I was like, oh, I get that, even though, yeah, I haven't played any of the games.
I wanted to talk about that a little bit. I've got a note down here. So the armor that you're seeing them wearing, that is NCR Ranger armor. And the NCR Rangers were the most elite of the elite in the NCR forces. They were originally not a part of the NCR, but in a treaty between the Rangers of Nevada and the New California Republic, the Rangers of Nevada joined the NCR and became the NCR Rangers. And this was known as the Ranger Reunification Treaty. In Fallout New Vegas, they have a big statue made of scrap metal at the border between Nevada and California. And it depicts these, an NCR soldier and a Ranger shaking hands, and it's got a whole plaque to memorialize the event. So seeing this armor was a really big Easter egg to the New Vegas game and the NCR Rangers. It's definitely one of the most iconic pieces of armor aside from power armor in the Fallout universe.
And continuing with this scene, these two individuals who are scavenging for metal take the metal that they've found back to where they're living and throw it in basically like a metal recycling unit that like melts down all of the metal for them to use for some sort of, I don't know, for something. They don't get into what they're using it for.
The ghoul made a like very small comment saying that they were lead farmers, so I wonder if they're maybe producing bullets or selling lead to some other faction to produce bullets, something
like
that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, because when they were scavenging, one of them like found like a handful of bullets in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's probably what it's being used for. They walk back into their home and the ghoul is there. It turns out that the duo is a father-son duo. The ghoul is eating their dinner before them. And the father and son seem to be very worried that he has killed one of their family members, but it turns out he just made the father's daughter make dinner for him. Very merciful of the ghoul, out of what we've seen out of him so far. I think he probably has a soft spot for children, you know? He had a kid of his own.
Yeah, having had a daughter himself, he definitely has got a little bit of a soft spot there. I mean, just in general.
He has a soft spot for dogs, so.
Yes.
He probably has a soft spot for kids, too.
Hope that he has a soft spot for kids and dogs. Not so much for adults, but at least for the innocent people and animals that are roaming around.
Yeah, and in this scene, the ghoul gives us a little bit, just a teensy-weensy bit of lore on the NCR Moldaver and the man's other son. Not the son that is presently there, but the other son that is not there, and how he's working for Moldaver. And basically, he purposely aggravates the son who's there as much as possible so he can quick draw, kill him, and leaves.
Yeah, I'm not sure if... Did he kill him, or did he just shoot him in the shoulder and incapacitate him? Because I think he might have spared the son
I thought he shot him in the chest.
Maybe.
I don't remember, though, fully. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I could check right now. Let's check right now.
Okay.
It was episode 7, right?
Yeah. Character's name was Tommy.
Let's see, fucker. I can't tell if he shot him in, like, his left nipple or his forearm. Or not his forearm, but his bicep.
Yeah, I mean, either way, I don't know that we're probably not going to see him again anyway, so it probably won't matter.
I just feel like it would make more sense for him to kill him, because this whole thing was, is he going to shoot me later? Is he going to hunt me down? Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
That's true. We also got some little hints about the father, who I'm assuming used to be an NCR Ranger, right?
I mean, yeah, it only makes sense, right? Because he has the armor.
Yeah, he must have come into contact with the ghoul before and shot him, because the ghoul makes a little comment about how he's got some of this guy's lead inside of him still. So Tommy just immediately spilled the beans on where Moldaver is. He didn't put up too much of a fight, to be honest.
To be fair, his whole family was being held captive before his eyes, basically.
Yeah, that is very true. Especially his little sister. I'm sure that if it had just been him and his dad, maybe, but the little sister probably changed things quite a lot.
Yeah. After the ghoul shoots Tommy and walks out, we cut to Cooper is at the meeting in a funeral home in a... where usually a service would be given, but Moldaver is talking, and basically he doesn't like the rhetoric being said, so he tries to walk out, and Moldaver's like, wait, starts flaming him, and gives him a listening device to bug his wife's Pip-Boy with, and he takes it.
Yeah, I think that there's a few really good lines here. One of them is when they are talking about Cooper being essentially a vault tech sellout, which he is. He says that in capitalism, everybody's got a sponsor, and his just happens to be vault tech. You know, he tries to put up a little bit of a moral defense for himself, but you can tell that he's distrustful a little bit. He knows there's some shady stuff going on with Vault-Tec, even though he doesn't want to admit it to himself.
I feel like there couldn't be anything right about a company that's that powerful, you know?
Yeah, everyone keeps dropping the line of selling the end of the world, and yeah, I don't know how you can't trust a company that's quite literally dependent on the world ending.
Yeah. And after this scene, we to captured Lucy in like a cell in Vault 4, where she's shown a video of the original Vault 4 overseer basically being just a psycho and everything falling to ruin. And she learns the real lore behind Vault 4 and that these people aren't actually bad, which was honestly super surprising to me. I thought this was gonna be like a whole different thing, last a while longer, in all honesty. I thought there were gonna be much more nefarious people. It's just that the Vault 4 overseer is actually just a xenophobe, and that's it.
Yeah, and this also gives us a look into, or maybe a not so much a look, but a clue into the fact that Moldaver is quite possibly not as evil as we thought. We saw that a little bit with the flashback with Cooper, how she's questioning Vault-Tec and is anti-Vault-Tec, possibly just trying to fight against this company that is doing some shady shit. If the citizens of Vault 4 are revering Moldaver, then maybe Moldaver isn't so bad if they're not so bad.
True, I didn't even think about it at the time.
The line about the axolotl creature being his great uncle Steven or something like that, about being the overseer's great uncle is hilarious. That was so good.
So Lucy basically in cuffs gets dragged by Maximus's room, and Maximus sees, and he finally decides to take action. He puts the popcorn down, but then it cuts away to Thaddeus, where he's limping to the trunk of a car to finally get some rest, and he pulls his sock off, and you see the most disgusting foot on the planet. Bro's toes hanging by a thread. That shit was disgusting. The dog licks his foot, which is yuck. But then he's just the worst person. Animal abuse, shoves dog in Nuka-Cola bin.
If you didn't hate Thaddeus before, I fucking hated him after this.
Not gonna lie, I did not hate Thaddeus before. I felt like he wasn't a great guy, but he wasn't as bad as Maximus.
Yeah, the only thing it takes in a show for me to absolutely despise
animal
a character.
Animal abuse, yep.
Yeah. Animal or child abuse, and that's like, okay, now fuck you, you're done.
Yeah. We cut back to Vault 4, where basically a fake execution of Lucy is happening. Like, it's set up to look like they're gonna fucking chop her head off, and then they cut her cuffs open and give her supplies. 2 weeks worth of supplies for the Wasteland, because they think the Wasteland is so brutal that she's instantly gonna die. Which, honestly, the facts, though, like, if you're not goated like Lucy, you probably die instantly in the Wasteland. But yeah, they give her 2 weeks of supplies. Maximus had already stolen the fusion core, put it in his power armor, and goes to town on these vault dwellers, beating the shit out of a ton of them, flipping tables, breaking shit. And then Lucy has to like inform him that it, like, oh shit, this is not actually bad, and these people are quite nice, and we could just leave. So they leave, and Maximus, through his own moral quandary with Lucy, decides to give back the fusion core and abandon his power armor.
Yeah, and then Lucy makes a comment about how if her father found out that a community was harmed for his benefit, he just would never be okay with that.
Which is quite ironic by the end of these two episodes.
You know, at least Maximus made the right decision here. He's starting to maybe...
Yeah, he's getting a little bit of brownie points for that.
Yeah, I think Lucy has been a good influence on him. His morals are starting to strengthen a little bit. He's learning how to do the right thing.
And then we cut back to Thaddeus, and he's in the Wasteland, limping towards a man for help. The guy who was fucking chickens earlier in the series. Basically, the man claims he's a doctor and that he can help Thaddeus. Thaddeus accepts his help and his foot is healed, but it's with the item that the ghoul uses to use his vials. And suspiciously, the doctor basically books it out of there as soon as he gives Thaddeus the medicine. So I feel like when I was watching this, I felt like something kind of ghoul involved was gonna happen, which we learn does happen.
Yeah, and the doctor also makes a comment about, after Thaddeus says Shady Sands is super irradiated, I don't want to go near there. The doctor's worry about it. Radiation should be fine for you now, buddy boy.
Yeah.
you know who this fucking quote-unquote doctor looks like to me?
You?
No. He looks like fucking Schmeagol from the third Lord of the Rings
Lord of the
movie
Rings.
In the flashback.
Oh
yeah.
My god.
Doesn't
I think
he with
Schmeagol
the sunken eyes?
Didn't look as dirty though.
And as far as we know, Smeagol isn't out here fucking chickens. I mean, I don't know. Maybe.
I feel like Gollum might have gotten down with some chickens, TBH. All right. In our next scene in episode 7, we see Norm putting something in the prisoners' food, and then shortly after, they're all dead. So, it's safe to assume Norm poisoned all the prisoners in Vault 33.
Yeah, without a doubt. And Stephanie kind of goaded him into it, right? She was like, oh, your father would have done the right thing and gotten rid of those prisoners.
Yeah, kind of. She was like, I agreed with what you said, and your father would have done the right thing. Like, she basically made him do it, TBH. I mean, he was gonna do it anyways, if we're being honest.
Betty doesn't outright accuse him of killing them, but...
I mean, they literally arrest the other person, so...
No, yeah, she doesn't accuse him of having done the poisoning himself. I don't think that Betty thinks Norm is capable of that.
She accuses him of influencing it, though.
Yes. Yeah, she accuses him of being responsible for it, and it goes back to that whole point she makes a few episodes ago about how Norm's voice carries power in the vault. So
yeah,
even though he might not have the willpower to do it himself, which she misjudges him on that, but even if he doesn't, she thinks that he had something to do with the fact that it happened.
Yep. All right. And then the Vault selection. We see every person in Vault 33 get their assignments, whether they're going to stay in Vault 33 or move to Vault 32. And we see the people that are happy and unhappy about their selection.
Woody, who is the guy who lost for Overseer, who was like the tertiary candidate. I don't think he ever had a real chance of winning. Well, obviously, Reg didn't have a real chance of winning either, but I think Woody even less so. You see him really distraught about the fact that he's been assigned to 32. Go ahead.
Oh, wait, never mind. That's later in the episode.
I was going to say...
Yeah, ruined your train of thought, idiot.
Fuck, what was I going to say?
Nothing.
That's not important. Let's move on.
Does he never have anything useful to say?
That's true. I only yap about fucking nothing. Like the Charlie Brown parent.
Yeah, like an Animal Crossing character. Alright, the next scene is the ghoul rolling up to the gas station where Thaddeus first took off his sock and saw his disgusting foot, and he finds the dog and frees him.
Thank God.
And then we cut back to Cooper, who throws away the listening device and then later digs it back out of his garbage.
Yeah, he really tried to kind of trust his wife there for a minute, and then he was like, oh, some shady shit's going down. Maybe I need to actually listen in. Cooper is right to be suspicious, so he digs the listening device out and decides to do the morally questionable thing and spy on his wife.
And then it quickly cuts back to a short scene of the ghoul petting the dog in the wasteland in resemblance to Cooper petting his dog back when he was a human.
Yeah, and this is the first time we see the ghoul call the dog dog meat, right?
Yes, I believe so.
If you listen to our, I think, episodes 1-3 review, I had mentioned that that was almost definitely going to be the dog's name because it keeps in line with the Fallout tradition of the main character's dog being named Dog Meat. I'm glad they decided to stay with that.
The next scene is Lucy and Maximus following her Pip Boy's tracker towards the head that Thaddeus has taken to a radio tower, surrounded by human killing traps. And when they get there, they confront Thaddeus, and Thaddeus is backed into a corner and gets shot in the neck by a crossbow trap. And this is where they find out he's a ghoul, because he just pulls the arrow out of his neck and it instantly heals. So Maximus decides to take the heat for Thaddeus and Lucy, because Thaddeus called in the Brotherhood to save him, but now that he's a ghoul, they know he's just gonna get executed. So Maximus takes a fake head and gets ready for the Brotherhood to collect him, while Lucy runs off with the real head and Thaddeus just runs off in general.
Lucy and Maximus share a kiss before they depart from one another. Also, I've mentioned that there were going to be a lot of game connections in this episode. The whole fiddle music thing is a big Fallout 4 reference. The Minutemen, which is a faction that the player character leads in Fallout 4, eventually you retake this pre-war Revolutionary War fort called the Castle, and you set up this radio tower that just transmits that song on loop all day, and it's called like Freedom Radio or Minutemen Radio, something like that. So the whole joke about people not being able to respect the fiddle music is a joke about how the players of Fallout 4 thought that that radio station was so fucking annoying.
That's pretty funny.
So that was fun. Also, it was the guy from Portlandia.
Yeah.
The fun cameo.
All right. And then we head into the last scene of episode 7, where we see the Vault 33 people who are assigned to Vault 32 moving into Vault 32, where we see Woody does not want to move into 32, but the two guards force him to stay for the moving. And we see this is a little power move by Betty, you know, a little hostile. She seems like she might be getting rid of her competition in the vault, while also securing a Vault 31 dweller to live in Vault 32. So I think we know who their overseer is going to be, and that's going to be Stephanie.
Yeah. Stephanie, I know that she's probably involved with all this shady Vault 31 shit, but you got to admit, with the eye patch and everything, she looked pretty badass being assigned to Overseer.
Oh, of course.
What I want to know is where the fuck were these armed guards when the goddamn vault was being torn apart by Moldaver and the Raiders?
Yeah, I don't fucking know, man.
Did Betty just create this paramilitary task force in the wake of Vault 33's raid? Or were they just not on duty that day?
I mean, to be fair, you probably don't expect to need to have guards at a wedding.
No, but you also don't expect to need guards when people are moving to a different area.
I mean, maybe, though, because, I mean, I feel like Woody's reaction is not something that's unpredictable, you know? Like, people might not want to have to move in general, even though they had no choice, and they just got fucking selected, you know?
That's true.
I mean, it's entirely possible, though, that she just made that shit, though, because it might be just a hostile takeover at this point.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like she's above using those kinds of tactics to keep control. The other thing that I was wondering about the whole vault situation, now that they don't have the added population of the dwellers who are living, or who would have been living in the vaults that were former raiders, do they have enough people to sustain both vaults?
I mean, they have enough people to sustain their own vault, right? So they should be able to just, like, sustain themselves, right?
True. My assumption was that the only reason they were going to be able to do this whole 32 repopulation program was because they had some additional manpower that they could integrate into Vault Society. And without that, it seems like both vaults are going to be kind of sparse.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. They also do need a water chip, don't they? Like, didn't their fucking water chip break?
It
did. What happened to that?
I'm wondering if both vaults have their water chips broken, or if it's just 33.
I mean, it should just be 33, right?
Yeah, so maybe they're gonna have some kind of trade program where, you know, 32 supplies the water, and 33 helps out with some other stuff.
Yeah.
Seems like a good solution in the meantime.
And then we also see Norm kind of lurks away from the send-off, gets into Betty's office, and tricks the overseer in 31 to think he's Betty and gets into 31. And right before the cutoff end screen, he sees something that confuses him and worries him.
Yeah, he's got that look of shock on his face before it cuts to black. So he's gonna find out the truth about Vault 31. Old Norman over here doing some detective work once again. All right. Do you have any thoughts or notes on episode 7 before we move on?
Just that I enjoyed it.
I'm with you on that one. I think it was a good episode to set up everything that's going to be happening in episode 8. They did a good job with this one. Really building the mystery, answering a couple of questions, and showing us that we're about to get some answers to our big, big questions, like about what's fucking going on in these vaults, what's going on outside, and resolves a few things about Thaddeus and Maximus. Gives kind of Maximus an out to return to the Brotherhood as well.
Yep.
Before we move on to episode 8, let's take a quick break.
Before we move on to episode 8, let's take a quick break.
Is that what I sound like?
Yep.
And we're back. Let's get right into episode 8, the beginning. We open on Maximus being taken back to the Brotherhood, where they've taken over the town of Philly by force. We learn the truth about Dane's foot injury. Dane admits that in an attempt to not go out into the wasteland, they put the razors in their own boot so that they wouldn't have to be called to duty and serve as a squire for the Brotherhood and serve with Knight Titus. This comes after the leader of this chapter of the Brotherhood, Elder Cleric Quintus, accuses Maximus of basically what he's done, not gonna lie. Accuses him of having the soldiers around him come to great misfortune. Just not an unfair assessment of the situation. Chase, what did you think about Dane's confession that it was actually them who put the razors in their own boot and not Maximus? This was pretty surprising to me.
When they said it, I didn't think it was that crazy. But at the same time, I was like, damn, really? Maximus didn't do it?
No, yeah, I was so convinced that it was Maximus that just any other theory was not coming to mind for me. I couldn't believe that it was anything other than that.
Yeah, I really didn't expect it to be Dane.
That kind of redeems Maximus a little bit for me. Maybe
just a teensy weensy bit.
Yeah, the show is trying to show us a little bit more every single episode for the past few that Maximus isn't as bad of a guy as we might have made him out to be in the beginning. He's still got a long way to go before I would consider him a hero of any sort, but he's making progress.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, then we move on to Lucy being taken to the observatory, where she finds out that it's an NCR stronghold, and this NCR stronghold has a little thriving community inside. She also has some flashbacks to when she was a kid. She sees her mother and herself in this field that looks really similar to the settlement and farm that's in the observatory.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. As soon as I saw the cornfields in the NCR with Moldaver knowing who her mom was, I like instantly was like, oh shit. Lucy was definitely here with her mother at one point.
Yeah, and in the episode where Lucy talks about her memories of childhood with her mother, she mentions that
feeling the sun on her skin, yeah.
The sun felt real, and she was like, oh, it was just my mother made it feel real to me. Which was a nice sentiment, but we find out that it wasn't just her mom that made it real, it was actually fucking real.
Yeah, it was just actually the damn sun.
Yep. The ghoul follows the dog through the wasteland and tries to track down Wilzig's head. We then cut to Cooper taking his wife to work, and he bugged her Pip-Boy. He puts the listening device into his ear and hears her conversation, but it goes to static and kind of cuts out. Lucy walks into the NCR base, and she finds Moldaver having a feast with her dad, who's locked up in a cage.
Like a bird cage, basically.
A fucking bird cage in the middle of this room. And across from Moldaver at this feast, there's a ghoul strapped, a feral ghoul missing an arm, strapped to a chair.
Okay, I'm not gonna lie. We learn this later in the episode, but as soon as I saw this ghoul strapped to the chair, I just knew it was Lucy's mom. Like, I don't know what it was, but I just immediately was like, there's no way. There's no other reason for a ghoul to be strapped to that chair.
Yeah, I was waiting for some weird, like, oh, we need a ghoul blood to start up the artifact, or I don't know. I just didn't clock that it could have been the mother. I should have gotten that a little bit sooner, but it just didn't occur to me, so.
Yeah, I think it was just the combo of me thinking about Lucy's mom basically just being with her on the surface in that cornfield, and then the next scene with Lucy, she sees her dad, Moldaver, and a female ghoul at the table. I was like, there's no way that's not her mom.
I did look at the credits, because you know how Amazon has the actors and who they're playing on the side when you sort of scroll around? When I opened it up, before they even revealed who the ghoul was, the actor was credited as Ghoul Rose McLean. Amazon did ruin the surprise on that one a little bit for me, but that's all right. Moving on, we see Norm meeting with the overseer of 31, who is Bud Askins from the pre-war times. Not quite looking how we expected Bud would look after all this time. He's a brain in a jar, and Bud is credited as Brain on a Roomba. That's quite literally the character's name when he shows up like that. So this is like a known quantity in the Fallout universe. These robots where the brains are inside of little jars on top. These are called RoboBrains. Pretty self-explanatory name there. But they're known especially for, even though they have a human brain inside them, they've got super flawed robot logic. Like wanting to wipe out humans so that they can save humanity because they think humanity is the problem. Just all these weird paradoxical thought structures. And that kind of lines up with what Bud's plan is here, right?
Isn't one of the main bad guys in one of the Fallout games the brain in a jar guy?
I think that you're thinking of the Master from Fallout 1, right?
Yeah.
Where he's in the computer. So he's not a RoboBrain. He's a mutant where he fell into a vat of sort of mutative goop called the Forced Evolutionary Virus. And he had to like crawl his way out of the vat as this slop of human goop, like this unmolded slop of human goop. And he wraps himself around a computer and like integrates himself with a supercomputer and starts adding people to his massive flesh and gets their personalities. Yeah, the Master is a fucking creepy villain, but he's a cool one. So not a RoboBrain, but kind of the same concept of human and machine being fused together. Now we move on to Cooper waiting in his wife's office, listening in on her meeting, and we get this little tidbit about someone named Henry, who is his wife's assistant, wanting to meet him. So he sits down in the waiting room, and this fella Henry gets called in to meet him.
Also, the person who tells us about Henry is Betty.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah. Young Betty Pearson.
Young Betty Pearson. Damn. We see young Hank meeting Cooper, and we finally get the answer to the question of why the ghoul seemed to know Hank.
Yeah.
Yeah, we finally get that answer. I kind of figured that there was something like this, but I didn't think that it would be all these characters are going to be from the pre-war times. Did you?
No, I didn't expect any other characters really besides Cooper / the ghoul to be from pre-war times.
Between all of the buds, and we see Moldaver has somehow made it through, the ghoul has made it through. A lot of people who were kind of in this Vault-Tec circle in the pre-war times, they've made it through one way or another into the apocalypse. It's kind of impressive, actually.
Yeah.
We cut back to Lucy realizing the truth about her father. As we get the reveal that her father is from the pre-war times, Moldaver starts to tell her all of the dirty little secrets and explain the whole process of cold fusion and the fact that she needs a Vault-Tec employee in order to make it happen. She explains that cold fusion will provide unlimited energy, clean water to the wasteland, and that Vault-Tec had made it a priority to keep this tech buried. I'm assuming because it would kind of fuck with them bringing about the end of the world, right? Unlimited power and energy, sort of.
I mean, yeah, once you produce unlimited power and energy, there's no conflict. Everyone has what they need.
I don't think that we had talked about this, but the war that was happening between China and America that people assumed was the cause of the end of the world.
I'm assuming it's a oil war.
It was a war over oil and uranium, yeah.
Makes sense. Alaska, oil.
All the oil in the world started to run out, and then everyone sort of switched to nuclear, and then the fucking uranium and plutonium started to run out as well. So all the remaining resources on the Earth became really scarce. Power became an unknown thing. The U.S. even invaded Canada and Mexico before the Great War happens. So,
bruh.
Yeah. They got greedy.
Absolute greed. Just gluttony.
The U.S. would never invade a country for their resources in real life.
Oh, true.
We're the good guys.
Basically, Lucy forces her father to give Moldaver the cold fusion code.
I'm surprised he does.
I'm not gonna lie. Yeah, it took, like, barely any convincing.
Yeah, he does seem to really care about his daughter. Despite everything that's happened, he definitely... I don't think that he's faking his love for his family.
Yeah, I think he definitely loves his kids, at least.
Yeah, at least his kids. I don't think he quite loved his wife enough.
Yeah, here, though, is also where we learn. I think one of my theories from, like, our first episode gets proven here, where I thought that Hank or Lucy's mom was gonna be the cause of the NCR's fall, like basically the second round of bombs dropping. I thought that would be more of a point of contention between Maximus and Lucy, but considering the fact that Lucy's dad is like full mask off evil guy now, yeah, no.
Yeah, he's fucking cold. He doesn't even try to deny that he was responsible. He does tell Lucy, oh, don't listen to her, don't listen to anything she has to say. But once Moldaver actually gets the words out, he's just kind of resolved himself to being like, ah, I did what I had to do to make this happen. I did what I did to protect humanity. The problem is the factions and the fighting, and we need to start over all over again. We need to kill everyone and have only one leader. Sounds like Vault-Tec isn't...
Bro just wants to be a fascist. Bro just wants...
Vault-Tec isn't preserving the ideas of the American dream and democracy. They're just straight up fascists in this.
It's also crazy because the NCR was built with a lot of help from Vault dwellers.
Yeah, a lot of the vaults that opened were sort of instrumental in becoming the NCR. So we're going to find out a little bit later some more about the vaults. We get a lot of critical lore about the vaults that I wasn't expecting to get from this series. But yeah, I kind of got the sense that the vaults are very separate, almost competing entities. Like, whichever vault comes out on top is the one who deserves to rule the wasteland.
Yeah, does seem like that.
Moving on, we see the scene where Barb is discussing with the board. Her and Bud Askins are discussing with the board all this shit about Vault-Tec, and Bud Askins kind of...
That was before this scene, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. We went out of order a little bit just because they cut back and forth in these two scenes a lot.
Yeah, they do go really back and forth right here.
We're back to Barb and Bud Askins with all of these leaders. of industry and technology in the Fallout universe. I want to talk a little bit about them in a moment. We see Bud offering them all their own little spots, offering them investment in Vault Tech. Now, Cooper has faith in his wife. We see her sort of get a message on her Pip-Boy. She looks up and she sees a shadowy figure. Do you have any theories about how who this shadowy figure giving her essentially her talking points is?
I have no fucking clue.
I have no clue either. My guess is either CEO of Vault Tech, maybe someone with the Enclave, like U.S. government.
I'm assuming it's someone we're going to see season two, because later on we see Hank head towards... We'll get to that later, but I think it's someone we're going to see season two involved with Hank.
Yeah, speaking of people who might be important to season two, the guy who's kind of pushing back the CEO of Robco, Robert House, a spoiler for New Vegas, he survives the Great War and is the controller of New Vegas. He reopened the Strip. He saved Las Vegas from a nuclear annihilation.
How?
So basically he built all these anti-missile defense systems around Vegas in the lead up to the Great War.
Holy shit.
Yeah, he spent all of his money trying to save Vegas. And so Las Vegas remains largely untouched by the war. Still 200 years have gone by and shit kind of falls apart. But in the late 2100s, maybe early 2200s, Robert House reopens the Strip, invites these three tribes in to become the three families of Las Vegas. They reopen the casinos. Robert House has this big robot army of these robots called Securitrons, who are fucking tanks. And yeah, he's a big power in the wasteland. In Fallout New Vegas, he makes some comments to the player character saying that he foresaw the end of the world, and that's why he did everything he did. But we kind of find out that it wasn't just his intuition. Barb legit told him point blank that they were going to end the fucking world. So,
I mean, didn't she literally say, what if we drop the bombs or some shit? Like, yeah, she basically went, like, I think last episode we were talking about how we thought that she was just someone who had power but not enough power to switch things up and was just trying to do the right thing to save her family. Yeah, that was wrong. Barb's just not a good person, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, she says that the nuke is an opportunity for these companies to have a monopoly in the fucking apocalypse, which who the fuck cares if you have a monopoly over the market when everyone is dead and no one can buy anything from you?
Yeah, I don't know. This is fucking ridiculous.
Before we move on to the next scene, we also see Barb deliver the tagline of the Fallout universe, which is "War, war never changes." Usually that line is delivered by Ron Perlman in the prologue of the games, in like the little opening cutscene. It's always the last line before you get into the games is Ron Perlman saying "War, war never changes." So that was a fun callback to the games as well.
The next scene after the Cold Fusion Core code is Norm getting basically trapped in the cryogenic pod area of Vault 31 by the Overseer and being goaded into getting into a cryogenic pod.
Yeah, I am wondering where that's going to go with a potential season two. Is he just going to be frozen in there until eventually someone rescues him? Is he going to fight his way out of the vault? This is the last we see of Norm this season, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it is.
Leaves a lot of open questions about the state of the vaults, what's going to happen there, this whole tri-vault situation. I'm sure the mystery is going to continue. I'm guessing that if there is a possible... Actually, I'll save this for our theories section. Let's move on to the next scene. So we see the NCR and the Brotherhood fighting one another. The Brotherhood rolls up in their vertibirds with all hands on deck. Knights, vertibirds, big-ass guns, they're rolling up. We see the NCR take anti-helicopter weapons and shooting down a few vertibirds, but most of them survive, and this scene is pretty awesome. This is where I thought that they really shined with the action. It was in this fight between the NCR and the Brotherhood.
Yeah, I think this sequence was really good.
It was done so well. The music was fantastic. They nailed the music in this episode, I will say.
Yeah, here we also see the ghoul roll up and lay down some heat on one of the knights, kind of giving us some more lore about how he used to wear one of the suits of armor and he actually knows it better than they do.
The ghoul shows up to the observatory and positively smokes the Brotherhood Knights. They didn't stand a goddamn chance against him.
He used, like, a special bullet, too, to, like, shoot one in the fucking belly or something, kill just a knight outright.
Yeah, he said that there was a weak spot in the welding underneath the chest piece, and apparently that was never fixed in production, so he shoots the weak point and blood goes spewing out of that power armor. Should have used that on Maximus in the second or third episode. Second episode, I believe.
I mean, I don't think he had that bullet. It looks like he special made it, but...
True. All right, so after the ghoul absolutely smokes the Brotherhood in the observatory, Max comes up and lets Hank out of his cage. And Hank takes a set of power armor, puts it on. Lucy holds a gun to her dad, and she just can't shoot him, so... He gets away and with his new power armor, and we don't see him until the end of the episode again.
Yeah, I think she also puts her mother out of her misery, too.
Yeah, that's a couple scenes from now, but she does end up mercy killing her feral ghoul mother, which was a really sad scene. The ghoul shows up, and I got a little bit ahead of myself. Before Hank makes his escape, the ghoul shoots him across the cheek, and then he gets away.
The ghoul also asks Hank where the fuck is his family at.
Yeah, I wonder if they're frozen in Vault 31, because they mentioned a special vault for management.
Well, because, no, Vault 31 is, like, Bud's buddies or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like the people that he like trained. I think we might see his family at wherever Hank is heading at the end of this episode.
Could be. And the ghoul delivers a pretty crucial line. He says that the wasteland looks like chaos, but in reality, there is always someone behind the wheel controlling everything. And in this case, it would be Vault-Tec. They orchestrated the apocalypse. They orchestrated the end of the NCR, even though the wasteland is fucked up and horrible and a rough place to live. There is someone behind the scenes making sure that everything happening is happening to their own designs. Pretty scary shit right there.
Mm-hmm. And basically after Lucy and the ghoul team up and dip, Maximus is left unconscious there, gets up, wakes up before the Brotherhood reaches him, finds Moldaver's body, and gets basically credited for her death. He tries to deny it at first, but then he's just like, oh well.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they knight him, right? They're like, knight Maximus.
Yeah, he's definitely gonna get a knighthood for... Even though he didn't kill Moldaver, he's getting the credit for it, and that's something that would be worthy of a knighthood for the Brotherhood.
I mean, yeah, they have power over their cold fusion now, too, so...
They do. That was Moldaver's dying act, was activating the cold fusion generator, and... Seeing the ruins of, I believe they're still in LA, seeing the ruins of LA light up, and I didn't expect that to happen, but it was a pretty cool scene to see the wasteland kind of come back to life, and now we just have to hope that the Brotherhood uses it for good, which I feel like we know that they're not going to. We've gotten a pretty good look at what kind of morals the Brotherhood has. Their whole philosophy of wanting to hoard technology and not share it with anyone else is going to prevent them from using it for the greater good, for sure.
Yeah.
Another thing that we see Moldaver tell Maximus right before she dies to try and change the Brotherhood from the inside and do whatever small part he can to make the wasteland a better place now that the Brotherhood is going to be owning this cold fusion technology.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they fucking at least share fresh water with people. Like, goddamn.
You would hope so, but the Brotherhood doesn't exactly play nice with others in most scenarios. They're not known to share their toys with others, even when their toys are fucking plentiful.
And the last actual scene of the episode is, like, Hank rolling up on what looks like Vault-Tec headquarters, and then it shows, like, a monster skull.
So that is the skull of a creature called the Deathclaw. Now, Deathclaws are these intelligent, fucking terrifying, big-ass lizards. And they were genetically engineered by the Enclave. And the Enclave at one point had, like, mind-controlled Deathclaws that they used as part of their forces and their army. But over the years, since the Enclave has fallen in a lot of areas, Deathclaws have just kind of become commonplace, giant-ass apex predators that wander the wasteland. They're fucking terrifying. If you've ever played a Fallout game, your first encounter with a Deathclaw, you think you're gonna die, and you probably did. Those things are tough. to kill. But yeah, Hank rolls up to what looks like New Vegas. Not what looks like New Vegas, but that is New Vegas, which makes me think that...
Wait, that was New Vegas? I thought that was the Vault-Tec headquarters.
No, that was New Vegas that he sees at the very end. Yeah.
But it was, like, so barren. There's, like, four buildings.
Well, you kind of see that there's walls up around it. You see the Lucky 38 Casino, which is the sort of Seattle Space Needle-looking building.
Yeah.
And
I thought that was the Vault-Tec headquarters.
So that's Mr. House's casino, where that's his, like, headquarters where he controls the strip from. I didn't see any of the neon flashing lights of Vegas, so that begs the question of whether or not it's actually still up and running in this timeline. We'll find out next season, apparently. But yeah, that is going to conclude episode 8, The Beginning. And it certainly feels like the beginning. I can't wait for what's next. You want to talk a little bit about theories and thoughts for possible season 2?
Oh, well, in season 2, I had some theories, but you said that place was New Vegas, and I thought it was Vault-Tec, so never mind.
We do know that Robert House was involved with Vault-Tec, so maybe Hank thinks that's a good place to go to get some answers. There is a vault in Las Vegas that, I don't know, maybe he's going there, but he's going to find out that that vault was opened and turned into a casino and hotel by Mr. House in the aftermath of the apocalypse.
Bro loves casinos.
No, legit. He fucking turned everything into a casino. And he was originally going to fill the vault with concrete when it opened, but the residents of the vault convinced him that it would be better off as a hotel. So, do you have any other theories? Even though we don't think that this is Vault-Tec headquarters anymore and we know it's New Vegas, what do you think is going to happen next season with the Brotherhood now controlling the cold fusion technology? What are they going to do with this shit?
In all honesty, I have no fucking clue where this shit is going. I'm just along for the ride.
It kind of seems like the Brotherhood, or at the very least this faction of the Brotherhood, they're trying to break away from the main faction, right? They're trying to go off on their own.
Yeah, they're trying to make their own Brotherhood, basically. They're like, when Maximus was talking to that fucking priest guy, he was like, we're gonna become our own power or some shit like that. And it was like, what the? This guy's greedy.
Yeah, I was looking up the name of the guy. It's Elder Cleric Quintus. And yeah, he goes to Maximus and tells him that he's gonna be the leader of a new Brotherhood, and people like Maximus need to be the sword of the Brotherhood going forward. So, factionalism is nothing new for the Brotherhood of Steel. They've gone through these sort of periods where each chapter has their own leaders and their own objectives. It seems like the Brotherhood is more cohesive and one unit at the beginning of the Fallout show, but seems like they're going to devolve back into the whole factionalism, each chapter having their own goals and leadership type of thing.
Yeah, I just feel like even though they have infinite energy now, I don't know how they're going to defend it. I feel like they've depleted so much of their forces throughout the show.
Yeah, and the way that people were so afraid of Moldaver, I don't think that that's all that's left of the NCR forces. I think that there's got to be more communities scattered around that have joined up with her. She seemed to have pretty widespread support, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the way that everyone was basically, you said her name and they started like cowering in fear, she must have other forces elsewhere.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of people are loyal to her. Anyone who survived the NCR and believes in bringing it back is going to be on her side. We saw that at the very least there are some families out there that have sort of heeded her call to action. Like, we saw Tommy in episode 7. We know his brother had joined up with Moldaver. We know he was helping Moldaver. I would imagine that there's a lot of people in the Wasteland who are sort of a part of her grassroots organization.
Yeah, they're here to bring back the NCR.
Yeah.
Which is not surprising, considering it was like the closest thing they had to real civilization again.
Yeah, we see the Brotherhood firsthand how they control the Wasteland when they roll into Philly and take over, and basically just have the place under military occupation, you know? It's not really... they're not trying to build a country, they're just trying to control things. But then again, the Brotherhood was never meant to be a nation in and of itself. It was just this paramilitary organization that wants to hoard technology. So I don't know what their long-term plan is for administrating humanity, but they don't seem to be too worried about it. They seem like they're just kind of, they're going to roll in.
I think we might see more of it next season with the infinite energy, infinite clean water shit. Like, they're probably going to be able to actually have an a real, like, handle over a civilization now. Because, I mean, earlier they were just building up an army, or up until now, basically, they were just building up an army, collecting powerful, I mean, not powerful, but technology, regardless of what it was, to, you know, gain an advantage, hoard it, basically, so that they could have it and no one else could. So, like, they're building their strengths in order to be able to control.
Yeah, and the same way that we saw that one airship roll in with all the knights and reinforcements to begin the campaign, I wonder if there's going to be more, like, if Quintus is going to maybe contact the Brotherhood in, I think he said, the Commonwealth, which is what would be Boston in our world, like the greater Boston area. We know that the Brotherhood has some elders and a lot of infrastructure there. I wonder if he'll call for more reinforcements to sort of shore up their operations in California now that they've got unlimited energy. The Brotherhood's not going to want to lose out on that.
Yeah, he might, but at the same time, I don't know what's his plan for when he's gonna, like, seize control, you know? Like, are those people gonna remain loyal to him or the true Brotherhood?
Yeah, it seems like Quintus is maybe not the most popular guy in the Brotherhood. I don't know how much sway he would have if he decided to go off on his own and sort of create his own Brotherhood.
I mean, I guess that's why he gave Maximus the whole "you're gonna be my sword" speech, too, though. He's probably gonna have Maximus put people in line, you know?
For sure. They mentioned promoting Maximus to a knight. There is a rank higher than knight in the Brotherhood, which would be paladin, and those are, like, the knights of the knights. And I wonder if we'll see Maximus get promoted to that next season, if he's really gonna be Quintus's right hand in this new Brotherhood that's being formed.
Maybe.
Yeah, one step at a time, though. He just got his knighthood. Can't be promoting him too fast.
I mean, he just got his fucking squirehood, too. So you never know with this fucking guy.
Yeah, that's true. He's got the ambition. He's got the drive to become high up in the Brotherhood. Yeah, we'll see if he can actually influence it in a good direction. I don't think that he's going to be able to be quite honest. I think he'll try his best at some point or another and kind of resolve to the fact that he can't do too much about it.
All right, before we close out, I think I'm going to give my final rating of the season. I think earlier during our episodes 1-3, I said it was about an 8 to an 8.5. I think now it's definitely like a 9 to like a 9.4, 9.5. Like, this really surprised me how good it was. I'm not going to lie. I know in our preview episode, I said I was expecting it to be good. I was not expecting it to be this good. This show is really, really good, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've never been so pleasantly surprised by a video game adaptation.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Holy shit. The video game adaptation rolled over so well. I mean, it's not an adaptation, technically. It's based off of the video game's lore, but I've never been so happy with a show based off of a video game before.
You just have to look at a few other examples. I'll not name names of what shows, but there's a few out there that are based on video games or take inspiration from video games that...
Oh, Halo!
Yep. Who don't exactly understand the source material. I saw an interview with Todd Howard on Instagram where he was talking about the writers and the cameramen, and he said that everyone involved in this project was just, they were Fallout fans. And it really came through. They understood the world. They were good writers aside from that fact. And that's what really made it so special. I think I said this a few episodes ago, but I would watch this show if it wasn't Fallout. If it was just a sci-fi post-apocalypse show, or some other story being told that had nothing to do with Fallout and it was the same general story beats, I would still love this show, and I think that that's the true testament to it being such a good show. I would put it in a similar place that you did. I think a 9.5 is a pretty fair place to put this show. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, I greatly enjoyed it. Also, I know that I think Jonathan Nolan was trying to get this show out, or trying to get a Fallout show made for like the past 8 years or something like that, which is really interesting to know. And also, last year we get Oppenheimer and then we get Fallout. Like, that's a really interesting dichotomy from the Nolan brothers.
Yeah, lots of nukes going on. I wonder if they... I wonder if Jonathan Nolan went to his brother Christopher and was like, hey, can I borrow a nuke for this? You said 8 years he was trying to get this show made?
That's what I heard when I was like researching it a little bit.
That's crazy. The other thing I heard about John, like related to Jonathan Nolan, is that when they were making Westworld, they took Fallout as like huge inspiration when they were making Westworld, which lines up with them knowing this property, because they already made a property that sort of took inspiration. So it just makes sense that they would refine it even more in this and create something that respects the feel of Fallout, respects the story, respects the source material.
I was going to say, I feel like they did Fallout a service, you know, they shed some light on it. They made it look good. You know, they didn't shade Fallout. They didn't make Fallout look bad.
Yeah, there's so many... When people make video game adaptations, or really any adaptation, it almost feels like they're afraid of the source material. And that kind of hinders the product. And they can't really tell the story that they want to because they're afraid of pissing off the original fans or deviating from the norm. And this show struck a great balance between telling its own original story and keeping in line with what makes Fallout Fallout.
Yeah, I mean, once again, never played the games. I know I've said that a million times on this podcast, but I feel like it needs to be said again, because I feel like they really kept the heart and soul of Fallout here in this show. Even though I don't really know the heart and soul of Fallout, I feel like from what I've seen of Fallout, it just feels so right. All of the characters feel to fall in with all, like, the scenes of Fallout I've ever seen. All of the costume design was really great. All of the set design was really great. The acting was great. Everything was so good, and I feel like they didn't take it too seriously, you know? They allowed it to be goofy at times, and it was fun.
Yeah, and that's part of the spirit of Fallout, is this universe that it's satire of the real world in its core, you know? It's satire about capitalism causing the end of the world and the way that humanity never changes. So the fact that the show didn't take itself too seriously and kept with that spirit, I think is great. And going off of what you just said about having never played a Fallout game, but you can still tell that they really captured the spirit of Fallout. And I think that that's a great mark of success for them, that they were able to have someone like you who hasn't played the games understand that, or understand what this universe is about and what's so important to it, what the core of it is. And you picked up on that, and that's a testament to how well the writers did.
Yeah, honestly, just a big thumbs up to the writers in general. I mean, it was great. The story was so intriguing at all points, and the characters were really interesting at all times. All
right, before we run out of things to say in our season wrap-up, do you want to bring us to our outro?
For feedback, guys, there are a few ways to contact us, first being email with fallout@thelorehounds.com. We also have a channel set up for our podcast, Radioactive Ramblings, within the Lorehounds Discord server, where you can send us a message or chat about the show. And you can also use the contact form or leave us a voicemail by going to thelorehounds.com. And please leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps other listeners like you find us. Finally, this will be our last episode covering this series, but remember, we will be releasing a reaction/response episode to all of the feedback you guys leave to our previously mentioned methods, so please contact us. All of this info is in the show notes.
Just to really put a point on it, please send us feedback either by email, any way that Chase just mentioned, because we want to hear from you guys. We want to know what you thought of the series. We want to know what your theories were, what came true. We want to know what your thoughts are on a potential season 2. So this is your call to action to just get us your thoughts on this. We want to hear from you. And if you want to be a part of the podcast, send us a voicemail. It's super fun. It's a great way for you guys to engage with the show, and you get to hear your own lovely voice on the podcast. So try and send us in some voicemails. We would love that. Before we let you guys go, we want to talk a little bit about the Barovian Podcasting Network. This is the podcasting network that we are a part of, and it is operated by the Lorehounds, our parent podcast. Now, one of the newest podcasts that has joined this little family of ours is Rings and Rituals. It's a show where Marilyn Arpaquila and Dr. Sarah Brown of Signum University analyze the Rings of Power Season 1 through the lens of ritual, while looking at the bigger Tolkien legendarium. They also look at ritual in our daily lives. They have podcasts out now and new episodes coming every other week. Next, Wool Shift Dust, which is run by Alicia, where she covers shows such as Beacon 23, Silo, and the Dune series. She's got an interview coming up with author Hugh Howie, where she is going to be asking some questions about the Wool Shift Dust series. So stay tuned for that one. Also got Properly Howard Movie Review, which has just come back from a hiatus. This is where two film lovers and old friends, Anthony and Steve, an academic and a comics, respectively, are going to be rating movies on a scale of better or worse than a Ron Howard film. They've got a new season theme, which is Felonies and Fugazis, where they're going to be talking about some crime and just some overall silly movies. These two are a hilarious duo, so give them a watch. The Lorehounds and Properly Howard are going to be doing a joint production to cover Severance when that comes back. We're waiting for news at the moment about season 2, but as soon as there's news on that, we'll make sure to update you guys and let you know what's happening. Last but certainly not least, our parent podcast, The Lorehounds, is currently covering Shogun on FX with the help of Alicia from Wool Shift Dust. They've got full season coverage happening with a season wrap-up and feedback episode coming, where they will have Nathan Ledbetter, a PhD candidate and member of the East Asian Studies Department at Princeton, coming on to help them and give some insight on the series. Nate has been giving some great feedback in the Discord, so check that episode out once it drops. Lastly, thank you guys so much for listening to us this season. Your support means everything to us, and we hope you'll join us for our final episode where we're going to be covering all of your listener feedback as well as our final thoughts and feelings on the season. We'll have some special announcements for you then, but in the meantime, thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you soon.